Transportation of America. Good morning, ma'am. You are?
Good morning, Abigail Lindenhoff.
Ms. Lindenhoff, good morning to you.
Good morning. May I please report? Again, my name is Abigail Lindenhoff, and I represent Steam Transportation of America and the claim I also refer to them as FTA. It's a bus company that runs route rapture primarily in Omaha. They do with students of all ages, including college. The appeal stems from a workers' compensation case in which the driver of an FTA school bus was injured when another car impacted her bus. The at-fault driver was the other party that ran into the bus, and Ms. Mabel was injured. Right away, Student Transportation of America started paying workers' compensation benefits, medical care, indemnity benefits for any time that she was off work. During the meantime, Ms. Gable also made a claim against the insurance company for the at-fault driver.
This never went to a court proceeding, right?
It did not.
So it's still settled.
Correct.
Well, the policy limits say that was a $25,000 settlement.
Yes, it was limits. And so during this time, we're communicating with Ms. Gable's attorney, and I think the timeline is important. Twice in 2014 and once in early 2015, I sent Ms. Gable's attorney a note saying, please keep in mind our subrogation interest. We've paid this much amount to date for Ms. Gable and her medical or indemnity benefits. Then, a few months after that, a plaintiff's attorney sent me a letter and said, oh, by the way, we settled for policy limits. Just so you know. Didn't offer to give us any of the money or even consider our subrogation interest.
How is this relevant to whether the Workers' Compensation Court had jurisdiction to consider anything having to do with this settlement agreement between Ms. Dingle and the at-fault driver?
How is the timing relevant?
Correct.
I think what...
Because that's the first issue we have to decide, right? Is does the Workers' Comp Court even have jurisdiction to resolve this issue?
I think it goes to two points. First, the timing, I think, is important because it shows whether or not the settlement was compliant with the Nebraska Workers' Compensation Act of settlement in a third-party case, which is like under 48-118. And all the statutes of the Workers' Compensation Court that address third-party settlements. And I also think it's relevant because it shows the reliance of plaintiff on that settlement, as well as our reliance in addressing the subrogation issues and payment of the impairment rate when it finally came due. So I think it helps understand the background of it before getting to the final issue, at least in my opinion.
But forgive me if I miss it, but why not go to district court on all this?
The defendant is not asking for a distribution of the settlement proceeds at this juncture. That is what we could have done at that point, but Ms. Gimple was still in the recovery phases. It would be another year after that settlement before she reached MMI.
To do that, where would you have had to go?
Would have had to file in the district court and litigate that whole thing in the district court when she hadn't even reached MMI yet. So from the work comp perspective, the case was still in its infancy. I mean, we hadn't even really completed discovery yet.
I beg your pardon.
Go ahead.
I'm trying to tie all these thoughts together. So when you learned of the $25,000 settlement, which evidently was limits, had you all paid the Ms. Gimple $25,000 or greater?
Yes. We had paid in excess. I think the first time I notified them, we paid in excess.
And $25,000 is the maximum to be gained?
Correct.
Okay.
And I didn't ever request the full out settlement.
Right.
I requested just acknowledgement that we had,
okay,
you know, some amount right to that.
What do we know about whether a release was given in favor of the tortfeasor, the at-fault driver? Was the liability insurance all of it? Was there a...
She did receive, I believe, settlement from her underinsured as well, but work comp can't make a claim against that, so that never became an issue. And
so we really don't have in our record a full picture of what she has received in a liability context as a result of the accident.
Correct.
But a district court would be able to get all that information.
They would.
And is there an action pending in district court currently regarding these issues?
There is.
And did you file that action? And if so, what relief did you seek?
I filed that action, and I sought relief of 2/3 of the $25,000 settlement.
And what are you asking us to direct the work comp court to do in this action?
I'm asking you to direct the work comp court to consider that settlement as compensation under the Workers' Compensation Act, because it kind of goes in a circle. And if you'll allow me to back up just a little bit, they got the settlement in August of 2015, so they're sitting on $25,000. We've paid out $40,000, and a year later, after I've sent multiple letters saying, "What about my subro? What about my subro?" A year later, they send me a letter that says, "You owe us $12,000 based on an impairment rating that we just got today." So after a whole year of sitting on this money, "No, you actually owe us." It didn't address the subrogation interest at all. I said, "Well, how about I take a credit for that $12,000, which is clearly less than what I was going to claim of the subrogation interest, towards the impairment rating that we owe." And then they filed a petition saying you should have paid the full impairment rating, and because you didn't, you get a 50% penalty.
How do you respond to the argument that Section 48.118.01 and this court's interpretation of it in Miller is that any issues regarding credits or settlements between injured persons and third parties is a matter for the district court to decide?
Well, I think Miller is, the facts are a little bit different in that one, because the settlement proceeds had already been distributed before the case actually went to the Workers' Compensation Court, and they're specifically asking the Work Comp Court, after proceeds had been distributed, how to distribute settlement or benefits that were paid subsequent to the distribution of benefits.
The holding was that the Workers' Compensation Court, because of the statutory jurisdiction, did not have the jurisdiction to make that allocation decision under 48.118. Isn't that the holding?
Yes.
And are you asking us to reconsider that?
No. I think the facts are different enough in Miller that they could be consistent with each other, because in this case, I'm not saying allocate those proceeds. I'm just saying allow those proceeds to be considered compensation for purposes of future benefits going forward.
You're asking for a credit?
Yes. I'm asking for it to be considered compensation, similar to the way that it was in the Thomas versus Lincoln Public Schools.
How would the Workers' Compensation Court know when to cut that off without allocating?
That would be something that would be to the discretion of the court.
Guided by what?
Probably, I would argue, guided by how much has been paid in the settlement and how much has been paid by the workers' compensation case.
So a dollar-for-dollar credit?
Potentially, but it would certainly move to avoid a penalty when it's clear that plaintiff's been sitting on it for more than a year. If there are no further questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Ms. Westerhold? Good morning.
Caroline Westerhold, on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Gimple, and on behalf of appellant on cross-appeal, Ms. Gimple. We believe the facts in this case are pretty simple. The appellee was involved in a compensable work accident on April 22, 2014. As a result of that injury, she sustained an injury to the left upper extremity, a fact that was stipulated to at the time of trial. She received treatment for that left upper extremity injury from Dr. Crabb. Dr. Crabb is the only medical expert and the only physician to offer any medical opinions in this case. As you've heard today, the accident was the result of a negligent drunken driver. A recovery was made against that drunk driver for the policy limits of $25,000. The recovery in the third-party case continues to be pending before the district court for determination as to both whether or not the settlement amount is fair and reasonable, and if so, an allocation or distribution of that third-party settlement amount. Much of the appeal that's been filed on behalf of the appellant in this case relates to that third-party settlement. As the court has touched on this morning, the Workers' Compensation Court is a tribunal of very limited authority, and that authority is specifically conferred on it by statute. Statutes pertaining to subrogation third-party settlements make very clear that jurisdiction on issues of credits, reasonableness, fairness, and allocations lie with the district court.
So what's driving this case? Avoidance of penalties?
I believe that that's basically the issue that we are left with in terms of issues on appeal that have merit. The issue was raised that the third-party settlement is actually void. 48.118.04 addresses when a third-party settlement is void. It makes clear that that determination lies with the district court. There's no jurisdiction for the Workers' Compensation Court to find that the settlement was void, and a determination in that regard has yet to be made by the district court in this case.
If the settlement was for policy limits, what would be the theory that it would be void?
I think that's an excellent question, Your Honor. I can only speculate as to the basis for the argument on behalf of appellant that this settlement is void, but I would agree, I feel confident that it will be ultimately found reasonable and fair by the district court, but I don't have the luxury of that finding here today. I find it also interesting that the argument presented by appellant in this case is that this third-party settlement that alleviates them of any responsibility to pay benefits by virtue of the credit that it provides is void. Certainly, if it is truly the position of the appellant that this third-party settlement is void, then there would be absolutely no basis for them to have not paid the permanent partial disability benefits owed by virtue of a credit from a settlement they deemed to have no validity.
Is there anything you can point to in the record as to the reason why the PPD benefits weren't paid? There's some talk about this left arm, right arm, wrist. Is that what's going on, or is it this other dispute about the settlement?
In the record, I think, going into hearing, the only basis presented at the time of trial for the nonpayment was that they were entitled to a credit. The Workers' Compensation Court should be entitled or had jurisdiction to assess that credit, and the settlement relieved their liability of having to pay that permanent partial disability benefits. The record, the evidence offered, very clear on that point. Things got a little confused when the Workers' Compensation Trial Court rejected our stipulation to an injury to the left upper extremity. At that point, the court viewed that as obviously a basis to have not paid. The court later entered a further opinion clarifying that it had incorrectly rejected the stipulation, thereby removing that basis for any reasonable dispute to have not paid. The only other reasonable basis that has been identified is that Dr. Crabb made a silly mistake as part of one of the many reports that he drafted in this matter. In the final letter that Dr. Crabb, and the only letter in which Dr. Crabb specifically addresses permanent impairment, he offers the opinion that the injury sustained was to the left upper extremity. He defines the extent of that injury. He goes on to say specifically that that injury has resulted in permanent disability and that that condition resulted in a 9% impairment to the left upper extremity plus an additional 4% to that condition. The entire scope of his opinion consistently references the left upper extremity. What he goes on to do in the very next sentence is add up the 9 plus 4 and he references the right. It is very apparent that the doctor made a Scrivener's error. It is very apparent that there was no confusion, no reasonable basis to say, gosh, do we have a left side injury or a right side injury in this case? So it would be the position of the appellee that served as no basis to support a denial of benefits. If that were to be the case, you would find parties scouring all the records for any instance in which any medical provider mistakenly said the right side or the left side. Having done this for a few years now, that happens all of the time.
Is there anything else in the record indicating the right side was ever an issue? And are there other things in the record that indicate that the left side was the issue?
There's absolutely no other reference to the right side. All of the medical records in this case, all of the evidence, all of the testimony presented was very specific to the left upper extremity. The right upper extremity was referenced on one occasion only, and in that one sentence and in the context that we've described to the court. From our opinion, that would be the only possible argument in support of a reasonable basis to deny benefits. I don't believe it passed muster to serve as a reasonable basis. I don't think what is a very obvious, isolated, mistaken reference to the right side somehow truly creates a reasonable dispute as to which of this individual's arms were injured in this case.
The district court's finding that there was a reasonable controversy or a reason to deny benefits, under what standard of review do we review that determination?
In terms of the district court, there's not been any determination by the district court.
The trial court, the workers' compensation court, found that there was, in their modified order, they awarded you benefits, but they said there's at least enough of a question, we're not going to impose penalties.
The trial court looked at two bases to deny the penalty. The first basis was, well, there was this issue here about whether or not it was the arm or it was the wrist. I don't see that reasonable basis existed after the court acknowledged that it had to accept the stipulation of the parties. There is a stipulation before the court that the court has accepted, whereby the parties agree the injury is to the left upper extremity. So I would disagree with the court's finding that there was, at that point in time, still any dispute left as to whether or not this injury was to the wrist or to the left upper extremity. The other basis identified by the trial court in denying the penalty benefit and attorney fees and interest was the issue we just discussed with the Scrivener's error, as the trial court referenced it. Again, I don't think that passes muster to relieve a defendant of its obligation to pay workers' compensation benefits. The system is set up such that benefits get paid. By virtue of those benefits paid, a subrogation interest exists. To suggest that a defendant in this case has lost access or ability to recover on the subrogation interest paid, I think is inaccurate. That ability to now seek and recover any benefits paid for permanent partial disability benefits extends to their subrogation. Their subrogation increases as a result of those payments. I don't believe it works in the opposite fashion that there's a settlement, I don't have to pay. I believe it works, you have to pay, and by virtue of those payments, you have the subrogation that then exists. Unless there are any further questions, I have no further argument for the court this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 1 minute and 25 seconds, Ms. Wenninghoff.
The two things I want to address, the first one I think is the easier one. I think there was a reasonable controversy on payment of the impairment rating, not only the right and left thing, because there was nothing else in the record on either arm. The Crabb letter was the one thing.
But if you read it in context, isn't it pretty clear he's talking about the same injury that your client stipulated to and that he refers to as a left injury earlier in the letter?
I knew it was, yes. I think there's still, it potentially still creates a reasonable controversy, whether I personally had a pretty good idea, and part of it, the mistake was mine, in that I read it knowing which arm it was, but in Nebraska, impairments, injuries to the wrist are ratings to the hand and not the shoulder.
But there's nothing in our record suggesting that when you saw that report, you said to yourself, whoa, 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 I thought we were dealing with the left upper extremity, but look at this. Now it's a different game. That's not what you're saying happened.
No. I didn't ever say that it was the right or left thing. My issue.
So it didn't affect your decision on whether to pay the benefits.
No, it did not.
Okay.
My issue was whether it was a hand or a shoulder of the correct arm. And so when the judge said, do you want me to continue?
You may complete your thought.
Okay. When the judge said that he accepted our stipulation, I mistakenly stipulated that the injury was to the whole arm, when in actuality, per statute, it was to the hand. So I could not have stipulated to that under the terms of the workers' compensation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.